Under Evidence Rule 901, the requirement of authentication as a condition for admissibility is satisfied by evidence sufficient to support a finding that the matter in question is what its proponent claims. In a case where the defendant was charged with raping his unconscious wife, the Court of Appeals recently held that video evidence was sufficiently authenticated by the wife's testimony that she recognized herself in the videos. We'll be discussing that case, State v. Leggett, today. I'm Joseph Hyde with the University of North Carolina School of Government.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook with the North Carolina Conference of DAs.
And this is Turning States, a podcast for North Carolina prosecutors and others interested in the criminal justice system in North Carolina.
Joe, before we get to authenticating evidence at trial, there was another case involving a traffic checkpoint and a pretrial motion to suppress. Let's talk about State versus White.
State v. White, this was a case out of Robeson County. The facts of that case were these. Back in September of 2022, Captain Michael Seago with the St. Paul's Police Department organized a police checkpoint on South Old Stage Road in Robeson County to detect Chapter 20, that is, traffic violations. The checkpoint operated from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. on September 11th. Four uniformed officers stopped every northbound and southbound vehicle on South Old Stage Road to check for traffic violations. Defendant drove up to the checkpoint about 4:30 p.m. Captain Seago asked the defendant for his driver's license. The defendant said he did not have one. Captain Seago detected an odor of burnt marijuana emanating from the driver's side window. Asked about the order, defendant showed the officer a partially smoked joint, but denied that there was more marijuana in the car. Captain Seago told defendant to pull to the shoulder and exit the car. Defendant admitted that he had a firearm in the car and that he was a felon. Captain Seago searched the car, found an assault rifle and a plastic bag containing suspected marijuana buds, and defendant was arrested. In September of 2023, defendant was indicted for possession of a firearm by a felon. He filed a motion to suppress the gun. Actually filed two different motions to suppress, but it was both challenging the stop and the search of the vehicle. The first motion to suppress alleged that the checkpoint was an illegal seizure. The second motion to suppress argued that police lacked probable cause to search his vehicle on the basis of that odor of marijuana. By order dated November 4th, 2024, the trial court denied the motion to suppress. Defendant then pled guilty to possession of firearm by a felon, reserving his right to appeal the denial of his motion to suppress. Before the Court of Appeals, defendant challenged several of the trial court's findings of fact and challenged also the trial court's conclusions of law, arguing that there was error in the denial of his motion to suppress. There were a number of findings that the defendant challenged. I'm not going to go through every one of those. Two of them are worth a comment. The trial court found that the checkpoint followed the governor's highway safety program memo as a template. Under General Statute 20-263A, checkpoints must operate under a written policy that provides guidance for the pattern. The policy may be the agency's own or another law enforcement agency. The defendant challenged that, saying this checkpoint was illegal because it wasn't operating under a written policy. Like I said, the trial court found that the checkpoint, it had this written authorization that was signed by the chief of police, but then in terms of the policy, it just sort of cross-referenced what the Court of Appeals called this template, the governor's highway safety program memo. The trial court found that that was a sufficient written policy. The Court of Appeals found that the finding was supported by the evidence and so rejected the challenge to that finding. And then there was another finding that the defendant challenged. The trial court found that statistical information was considered in the selection of the location for the checkpoint. The defendant argued that that finding was not supported by evidence. The Court of Appeals noted that neither the Fourth Amendment nor General Statute 20-163.3A requires evidence of empirical data or statistical justification for the location of a checkpoint. Under the statute, checkpoints should be random or statistically indicated, but the statute goes on to say that subsection requiring that the checkpoint to be random or statistically indicated is not grounds for a motion to suppress. The Court of Appeals said the evidence supports the finding that Captain Seago complied with the statutory requirements for the location of the checkpoint. And then turning to the conclusions of law, there were three kind of conclusions here that the defendant challenged, two of them having to do with the checkpoint and then one having to do with whether there was probable cause to search the car. The two conclusions having to do with the checkpoint, the trial court concluded that the checkpoint had a valid primary purpose. The Court of Appeals, citing a case called State v. Veazey, said that police checkpoints are seizures, and when reviewing the constitutionality of a checkpoint, a court conducts a two-part inquiry to determine, one, the primary programmatic purpose, and two, the reasonableness of the stop. The necessity of ensuring roadway safety is a legitimate purpose. General crime control, however, is not. And it said, when there is no evidence to contradict the law enforcement's stated purpose, the trial court is permitted to rely on the officer's assertion of a legitimate primary purpose. Here, the trial court found and concluded that the primary purpose of the checkpoint was to detect and deter Chapter 20 violations. The Court of Appeals said, absent conflicting evidence, the trial court did not err on relying on the stated legitimate purpose. It rejected the defendant's argument that the trial court erred by accepting the officer's stated purpose without examining contrary evidence. The Court of Appeals said defendant basically didn't present any contrary evidence. With regard to the conclusion that the checkpoint was reasonable, the Court of Appeals recognized that to determine a checkpoint's reasonableness, the court must weigh the public's interest in the checkpoint against the individual's Fourth Amendment privacy interests. And there are a number of factors that a court is permitted to consider under the U.S. Supreme Court case Brown v. Texas from 1979. The court should consider 1, the gravity of the public concern served by the seizure, 2, the degree to which the seizure advances the public interest, and 3, the severity of the interference with individual liberty. In this case, defendant apparently conceded the first issue, and so the Court of Appeals jumped to the second and the third factor. Under the second prong, the trial court must decide whether the police tailored the checkpoint stop to fit its primary purpose, considering, again, a number of factors: whether the police spontaneously decided to set up a checkpoint, whether the police offered any reason for the particular stretch of road, whether the checkpoint had a predetermined starting or ending time, whether the police offered any reason why that particular time was selected. Here, the trial court found that 3 of those 4 factors weighed in favor of the constitutionality of the checkpoint. The findings supported the trial court's determination that the checkpoint was appropriately tailored. Therefore, the Court of Appeals concluded the trial court did not err in concluding that the checkpoint advanced the public interest. Under the third prong, that is, the severity of the interference with individual liberty, a court considers, again, a variety of factors to determine the impact on individual liberty. 1, the potential interference with legitimate traffic. 2, the notice given to drivers that they're approaching a checkpoint. 3, whether the location selected was by a supervisor or by the field officers, whether every vehicle was stopped or whether it was according to a set pattern, whether there were visible signs of the officer's authority, whether there were operational guidelines for the checkpoint, whether it was there was officer supervision, and then finally, whether there was permission from a supervising officer to set up the checkpoint. Again, this is a complicated test here. Here, the trial court considered a number of those factors, and the Court of Appeals said the trial court's findings support the conclusion that the checkpoint's interference with liberty was not so severe as to make the checkpoint unreasonable. Ultimately, the Court of Appeals concluded that the trial court did not err in concluding that the intrusion was no greater than necessary. Jonathan, I don't know about you, but all these multi-factor tests and multi-prong tests, I find the checkpoint cases to be pretty complicated.
I agree, Joe, and I was just thinking as you were going through it, especially even on that first prong, right, about the primary programmatic purpose. I think that's an important thing for prosecutors to keep in mind because, you know, they do also say in this opinion, they remind us that law enforcement officers can't validate a checkpoint that has an improper or unlawful primary purpose, you know, like setting up a checkpoint in the neighborhood suspected of having a lot of drug activity, you know, that the primary purpose really is because we think we're going to catch people with, you know, odors of drugs or whatever, and then try to sort of, you know, on the back end, validate it by saying, oh yeah, and also let's check for licenses and registration. It really does have to be traffic enforcement as the primary programmatic purpose. It can't just be a cover for something else. But then the flip side of that, you know, the part that you mentioned where they talk about how where there's no evidence in the record to contradict the state's proffered purpose for the checkpoint, then the trial court may rely on the testifying officer's assertion of the legitimate primary purpose. So it is complicated. I mean, it's kind of a strict standard, but at the same time, some flexibility on what they will allow as evidence to prove those things. But I agree with you on the second part, especially the reasonableness of the stop. It does. It gets very detailed, very technical. We're going to really be looking in closely at the facts of how many cars were coming through and, you know, how backed up did it get even, right? You know, what was the intrusion on the liberty of the drivers trying to pass through? So it can be complicated for sure.
And it goes back to that statutory requirement that there be a written policy or a plan, right? I mean, the goal here is to limit officer discretion so we're not targeting a particular kind of person or a particular kind of vehicle. And
right.
Again, as you said, not to check for general violations of law, but to advance the legitimate purpose of traffic safety and to check for traffic violations.
You know, I would agree. And I would just add for prosecutors arguing these cases to bear in mind, a lot of people don't like checkpoints. A lot of jurors don't like them, defense attorneys, maybe even your judges. You know, it just, On some level, I think a lot of people feel like this seems kind of un-American, right? That we're just going to set up a checkpoint and say, show me your papers if you want to keep driving down this road. And so we really have to be aware of these requirements and then be making that showing emphatically about this is not a substantial intrusion on people's liberty. It is operating according to this fair and clearly articulated plan, that it was reasonable and that the primary purpose was just traffic safety. And that's the kind of thing we do agree to, essentially, when we get out on the road, is that we're going to make sure everybody's got their license and that their vehicle has passed inspection and all of those things.
Yeah, and I guess for prosecution moving forward, then I guess Stacey White is a good case because it lays out all of those different prongs and all of those different factors that kind of have to be argued here. And I can see a defendant making an argument on appeal if the trial court doesn't do a thorough analysis of this very complicated test. That's going to potentially create problems later on.
But then, Joe, I mean, as you said, that's really only step one, right? Because then there's the question of, all right, now he's been stopped, getting into the car.
Getting into the car. This is sort of a shorter analysis. The defendant argued that the trial court erred in finding that Captain Seago had probable cause to search the defendant's car. Again, that checkpoint gets you only so far as the legitimacy of the seizure. But then to get inside the automobile, we also have to have probable cause. The Court of Appeals recognized that under the automobile exception, officers are permitted to conduct a warrantless search of a vehicle based on probable cause if it's on a public roadway. And then the Court of Appeals also said that the officer has probable cause to search a vehicle based on the odor of marijuana. And that was despite the recent change in the hemp laws. This was an issue I think, Jonathan, you and I have talked about before, cited a number of recent cases, State v. Little, State v. Dobson, State v. Teague. This argument that had come up, basically that once the General Assembly had passed the legalization of hemp, that it was no longer possible to distinguish illegal marijuana from legal hemp. So maybe the smell, the odor of marijuana, or the appearance of marijuana would no longer provide probable cause. So far, the Court of Appeals has rejected that argument, maintained the regime that we're familiar with, that the appearance or odor of marijuana will allow the officer to search the car.
Yeah, that part of the opinion, I agree, is not terribly surprising given what we've seen in Dobson, Teague, Little. I mean, that seemed like that they were confirming that all the old case law about odor and appearance was going to be enough to get PC. But I mean, Joe, there is this one, it's not the issue on appeal, really, but there is kind of this one throwaway line that jumped out at me a little about the, I guess, what would have been a sufficiency of the evidence argument. There's a line in here where it says, so though an officer's belief that what a defendant possessed smelled and looked like marijuana would not alone be sufficient to convict the defendant of a crime, that belief is legally sufficient to give the officer probable cause that the defendant was committing a crime. So the second part didn't surprise me, but the first part of that sentence sort of jumped out at me a little bit.
The suggestion that the odor or appearance of marijuana would not be sufficient to support a conviction. I mean, my understanding is the prior case law said that this was the one controlled substance we can get a conviction based on appearance or smell from a lay witness.
That is something that I think we haven't really seen, I guess, tested out as much in the case law yet on that distinction between the marijuana and the hemp. So that's not the issue that was before this court really to decide, but it's maybe something to keep an eye on as that may bubble up in the subsequent case law.
Yeah, just to close the loop on this, so the Court of Appeals basically said it recognized that the trial court here found that Captain Seago detected a strong odor of burnt marijuana coming from the defendant's vehicle. The officer asked the defendant about marijuana and the defendant produced this half-smoked joint. The Court of Appeals concluded that the trial court's findings supported its conclusion that Captain Seago had probable cause to search the defendant's vehicle based on the smell of marijuana. So ultimately, the Court of Appeals concluded the trial court did not err in denying the defendant's motion to suppress based on the allegedly improper checkpoint and the alleged lack of probable cause. I think the next case we had on for today was State v. Leggett.
Yes, State v. Leggett was the one we talked about in the introduction dealing with authenticating video. So this was also a case from the Court of Appeals that we got on January 7th, a case out of Wake County. In this case, the victim, who's identified as AT, they tell us that she first met the defendant back in 2007, and they began a dating relationship where she would stay over and eventually moved in with the defendant and then moved to a townhouse in Raleigh. Facts describe how the victim and the defendant would often drink together, but you know the defendant would get sort of irritated or passive aggressive with her if she wasn't really drinking like he was, and so sometimes she would just drink along with him. But there were times when she said that she noticed that she would feel different than what the amount of alcohol she drank would ordinarily make her feel. So their relationship continues. Eventually in June of 2014, the two of them got married. And she said after that, things really started to get more weird, that there was more of this arguing and this passive aggressive kind of behavior. But even more specifically, she said about once a month, something would happen where she would feel very different in the morning because of or after whatever she had consumed the night before, where she would not be able to remember what had happened. She talked about there were times where the defendant would prepare her a drink. She would take one sip and then would just wake up the next day and look over and see that she'd only taken maybe a single sip and yet had no recollection of what had happened that night. She also started noticing some weird medical issues that were popping up. She had bruisings and marks that didn't make sense, scars on her legs and her nose, even red marks on her throat. So she talked about in February of 2016, there was an occasion where the defendant had gone to something for work and had left his iPad at the house. She was trying to look through the iPad, accidentally took a screenshot of it while she was trying to restart it. She knew the defendant's password, so she used that to unlock it, to try to go in and delete the screenshot. But what she saw when she got in there was a video of her asleep on the couch. And the camera gets blocked, but she can still hear herself on that video. She can hear that she's waking up in the video, but she sounds really bad, moaning. She's in pain. So now she begins to look a little deeper. She opens up the email app on the phone. She wants to see if he had maybe sent this odd video to someone. She was aware of a couple of email accounts that he used, one called Rory Suggs, one called Will Leggett. But on this iPad, she noticed another tab for another email account, Rory Suggs 3, which she had never seen before. So she opened that up. She looked at the email inbox, and in there, she saw what she described as graphic photos and videos of her in severely compromised position. So she logged in to that using the same password, by the way, that she knew from the defendant, her husband, used on those other accounts as well. She forwarded as many of those videos as she could to herself and then deleted the sent messages. Later, after the defendant had come home and was asleep, she logged back in, finds all these videos. They're identified later when we get to trial as 4.3, 5.3, and 6.3 GP, depicting all these sexual acts. So again, she's forwarded all of these to herself. She recognizes that it's her in the video lying in the bed. She recognizes that it's their townhouse. She can even identify the defendant in the videos just based on his hands, his penis, even the ejaculation that occurs in the video. So she knows that it's him. She did not do anything to alter the videos or even know how to alter them. She just forwarded these emails to herself. On February 11th of 2016, she goes to the Wake Forest police. She meets with Lieutenant Perry, explains everything that she's found. The emails that she sent to herself are then transferred to a thumb drive, which they place into evidence. Later, when the police try to open up that thumb drive, they're not able to get into it or open them. So they actually send them to the City County Bureau of Identification, CCBI. And the defendant, based on all of this, is indicted for several counts of second-degree rape, misdemeanor, sexual battery. There's a superseding indictment, ultimately, for another count of second-degree forcible sexual offense. The sexual battery gets dismissed, but the case goes to trial, and at trial, the state calls John McAuliffe, who worked at CCBI as an expert witness about these videos. That witness is able to explain that this .gp extension is a one that's used for mobile devices, and that he was able to extract these videos and play them. There is, and this becomes relevant, there's a little bit of confusion about what the last access date was for these videos, that's being shown as 22nd of March 2016. And yet the envelope, the chain of custody for the thumb drive doesn't have an entry for that date. So he couldn't necessarily speak to exactly what the reasoning was for that, nor could any of the witnesses necessarily speak to the accuracy of the recording device. But nevertheless, the videos are admitted and the jury convicts the defendant of these three counts of second-degree rape, find him not guilty of second-degree forcible sexual offense. So he gets a sentence of 44 to 113 months, and then is also ordered onto lifetime satellite-based monitoring, even though, for example, his static 99 risk assessment came back with a score of zero, classifying him as below average. So those are the two issues that we're mainly talking about on this appeal. The first is about the authentication of these videos. Should they have been admitted? And he's arguing they were not properly authenticated because we simply didn't have the testimony. I call them the canon factors, right? That case, State versus Canon, that a lot of people refer back to, talking about what we normally would do to get a video authenticated and admitted as substantive evidence, which is that we need something in the record that shows, you know, that the camera was working properly, that it made an accurate video, the video has not been altered in any way, like we would do in, you know, cases with a loss prevention officer with a security camera or something along those lines. And we just don't have that here. And so the question is, was this video sufficiently authenticated through other means? And Joe, I will say, to my surprise, frankly, the Court of Appeals says, yes, it was. This was a sufficient way to authenticate these videos. They reference that, you know, we have that particular statute about authenticating videos, General Statute 8-97, that says a foundation has got to be laid. Normally, we think about doing this consistent with the case law, like Canon and Snead and all these other cases that have sort of set out those four factors we look at about the camera working and making an accurate video hasn't been altered. But they go another way. They just sort of go back to Rule 901. And they say, Rule 901 is our basic rule on authenticating evidence to be admitted at trial. And it lists out all these different ways a person might do it. But that is a non-exclusive list. You know, that is really just a list of examples of how a person might go about authenticating video. And we do that through having a witness with knowledge who can say it is what it purports to be, or like we're often doing with video, it's kind of a variation of the 901B9. We're showing that the evidence is the result of a known reliable process or system.
But John, I think another one of the ways to do that is through distinctive characteristics, right?
Exactly. That's the 901B4. And that's kind of what we're really dealing with here in this case, because the victim is testifying at trial, of course, and the victim is able to explain that under, like you said, that 901B4, you know, what are the distinctive characteristics of the evidence itself considered in conjunction with the facts and circumstances of the case. And they sort of run through and look at this stuff. You know, there's, I don't know, 7, 8, 9 different details that they're pointing out about why she was authenticating this video. She recognized herself in the video, laying on the bed. She identified the location as being the townhouse that they lived in. She could identify the date as being, you know, prior to 2010, probably 2009, based on when they lived in that particular location. There's the expert testimony that the videos were created on this particular date, you know, looking at the metadata or the file that showed they were created on June 20th. The victim, AT, recognizes the defendant or, you know, I mean, at least these body parts, right? His hand, his penis, or, you know, even what happens during ejaculation. She knows that because they've been married for years. And so these are things that she would know. And it goes on, right? She found the videos in this email account that's Rory Suggs 3, which is very similar to the account that she knew as Rory Suggs. And she even opens it using the same password of his.
Yeah, but Jonathan, what about the possibility of manipulation, of doctoring the video here? Because with the rise of AI, it just seems like more and more likely and possible for anybody to create a fake video, to create something that looks real, that appears to be legitimate, but depicts something that never actually happened.
I completely agree. I think that is sort of the interesting question that is raised by this case, Joe. I mean, you know, we do have case law that has talked about chain of custody for videos. In my experience, it's not something that really gets picked up on or argued about a lot in most cases. But I think usually that's because we've got the person like that loss prevention officer that I mentioned. You know, that person is coming into court saying, I know that the camera works. I know that it makes an accurate video. And also, I'm telling you, I looked at this video last week and it hasn't been altered in any way since the day I pulled it off the system, you know, when the guy got arrested in the store. And so the chain of custody is somewhat irrelevant. But you're right. I feel like it's a bigger question here, you know, especially when there was this some issue raised at trial about there. It seems like there's an access showing in the metadata that's not reflected on the chain of custody. So do we know that anybody may have messed with it?
Well, the other thing, too, that this was video provided to the police by the alleged victim, right? It wasn't something that the police go in and find the surveillance video. This is something that she forwarded through several email accounts and then delivered to the police.
Exactly. In this case, they sort of go back to that Snead case and they say, regarding chain of custody, the Supreme Court has been clear. And they have this quote, a detailed chain of custody need be established only when the evidence offered is not readily identifiable or is susceptible to alteration and there is reason to believe that it may have been altered. And I think that's a big factor in this case, right? I mean, she's still testifying, looking at the video and saying, that's the same thing I looked at on the iPad that terrible morning when I opened up the email and saw what I saw. And so there's no reason to think that it's been altered. But the big takeaway for me is that all this stuff we've sort of thought of as showing these four canon factors, I mean, here, this is the Court of Appeals saying the production of such evidence is not the only avenue for authentication of a video. That is a direct quote from the case. And so these are interesting times on this show. I mean, I think it's sort of at the same time that we're, you know, getting AI videos that could be incredibly realistic looking, we now have this case saying an incredibly realistic looking video with other facts and circumstances sufficient to lay an authentication would be a way to lay that foundation and get the video admitted. So this is interesting because this is, I think, contrary to some other case law. I think a lot of defense attorneys, if they were listening to this podcast, would say, what about these old cases we had, like State versus Sibley, you know, where they found a video in the defendant's home that appeared to show him holding a firearm right there in the same room, and yet that could not be admitted as substantive evidence because there was nobody to vouch for the accuracy of the camera. And this seems like going in a very different direction. I think at the same time, it's continuing a trend that we've seen, like State versus Winseth, the case we talked about not that long ago, where they said we could authenticate a video by offering it as a business record. You know, I think those two in conjunction, this and Winseth and, you know, other cases like Jones, where it was just hearsay from the homeowner that took the video, it seems to be opening a surprisingly big window of alternative ways to offer that video.
I think there was one other issue in this case, John. Wasn't there a problem with the satellite-based monitoring order?
There was, yeah. I'll just touch on that briefly, that that he was arguing that there was no evidence to support the imposition of a lifetime order of satellite-based monitoring, and the Court of Appeals agrees with him on that. You know, I mentioned the offenses that he was convicted of. Is he eligible for lifetime satellite-based monitoring based on those offenses? Yes, he is. However, you know, they cite to these statutes that say if you are convicted of that, right, then we're supposed to make this risk assessment. That's what the DAC does. They look at that static 99. But in this case, his risk assessment came back actually as a zero, right? A low risk of reoffending. And when that happens, the state has to present additional evidence to support a determination that the offender requires that highest possible level of supervision and monitoring, and that cannot be based on matters that were already addressed or considered in the static 99. Without that high-risk static 99 score, and in addition to the state offering additional evidence, the trial court has to make some additional findings to justify that maximum SBM sentence. And so anyway, the state was required to present some evidence on that, and we just didn't have anything here. And so in this case, they said that, sure, the statute provides for lifetime SBM, but 14-20823 does not determine who is or is not going to be subject to that lifetime satellite-based monitoring. We had to make a showing here to justify it, and there just wasn't anything offered. So that was error. But for me, the bigger, more interesting takeaway is potentially a whole new world on authenticating video under this State v. Leggett case. So pretty interesting. And then, Joe, the last one we had on was State versus Phillips, an indictment issue.
State v. Phillips, yeah. This is a case out of Haywood County. Back in June of 2022, defendant and two other men apparently drove to the house of the victim, the Berghouts, and had an altercation with Christopher Berghout. They beat up Christopher. Defendant then hit Christopher's wife, Jamie, with his truck as he was driving away. In December of 2022, defendant pled guilty to simple assault. The judgment was entered against him. Conditions of probation on that judgment included a no-contact order prohibiting the defendant from approaching the Berghout residence. Defendant apparently continued to harass the Berghouts. He was seen driving slowly by the home. He was observed sitting in his truck nearby. In February of 2023, defendant was in the Berghout's backyard, apparently firing off a gun. Jamie Berghout called 911. Two deputies with the Haywood County Sheriff's Office were dispatched. They arrived around 9 p.m., they found defendant near his own home, sitting in his truck. Deputy Wood greeted defendant loudly, approached the vehicle. Defendant then pointed a revolver at Deputy Wood. The deputies ordered the defendant to drop the gun. He slowly put the gun in his lap. They ordered him to exit the truck. Like I said, defendant put the gun in his lap. Then he refused to get out of the truck. He resisted. They forcibly removed him from the truck, and they arrested the defendant. And after the defendant was arrested, they found beer in the truck. Defendant was indicted in March of 2023 for assault with a firearm on a law enforcement officer, felony stalking with a court order in effect, and resisting a public officer. The defendant filed a pretrial motion to dismiss, contending that the stalking indictment was fatally defective. The trial court rejected that motion to dismiss, found that the defendant had sufficient notice, denied the motion to dismiss, but it did allow the state to amend the date alleged in the stalking indictment. And then during the charge conference, after the presentation of evidence, the defendant asked that the assault instruction include the language without justification or excuse. That's the pattern instruction includes as an element, first, that the defendant assaulted the victim by intentionally, and then there's a parenthetical, and without justification or excuse. Second, that the assault was committed with a firearm, and third, that the victim was a law enforcement officer or something else. And then fourth, that the defendant knew or had reasonable grounds to know that the victim was a law enforcement officer. Basically, the defendant asked that the trial court include that parenthetical and without justification or excuse. The trial court declined to include that parenthetical, and then the defendant was convicted of all charges. Before the Court of Appeals, defendant argued two issues. One, he argued again that his stalking indictment was fatally defective. Secondly, he argued that the trial court erred in its jury instructions on assault with a firearm on a law enforcement officer. With regard to the stalking indictment, you can't really tell from the Court of Appeals opinion precisely what the nuances of this argument are. I went back and took a look at defendant's brief. Basically, he was arguing that the indictment failed to allege the acts to satisfy either the harassment or the course of conduct theories of stalking under General Statute 14-277.3a. The indictment alleged that the defendant unlawfully, willfully, and feloniously did knowingly on more than one occasion harass Christopher Burgout and or Jamie Burgout without legal purpose and or did knowingly engage in a course of conduct directed at Christopher Burgout and or Jamie Burgout without legal purpose, as the case may be. Basically, the argument was that those two theories, that stalking under a theory of harassment or under a course of conduct, that the indictment had to specify the different acts that constituted that harassment or that course of conduct. The Court of Appeals rejected that argument. Citing State v. Singleton, the Court of Appeals said an indictment raises jurisdictional concerns only when it entirely fails to charge an offense. An indictment with non-jurisdictional defects will not be quashed by reason of any informality when they express the charge in a plain, intelligible manner such that the defendant has sufficient notice. Here, it said the stalking indictment alleged that the defendant did harass Christopher and Jamie Burgout, and the Court of Appeals said defendant failed to cite Singleton or to argue that he was prejudiced by the alleged error so that there was no problem in the trial court's denying the motion to dismiss based on an alleged defect in the indictment.
Joe, I am still trying to wrap my head around that a little bit, though. I mean, Singleton, it seems like stripped down to the absolute bare bones, was on appeal, we're not going to throw something out on a jurisdictional defect because it wasn't as clear or perfect as it could have been. And if you had an issue with that, you should have dealt with it at the trial court level. But it seems like that's what the defendant was trying to do here, right? I mean, because as you said, the language was kind of vague, right? I mean, the indictment just says, did on more than one occasion harass and or knowingly engage in a course of conduct. I mean, that's pretty much the extent of the detail. And so he's arguing at the trial level, hey, that's not putting me on notice. I mean, what course of conduct? I don't know what you're saying I did. And so I am raising it at the trial level, and yet still he gets no relief. So what was he supposed to have done to instead, if that was not the right way to challenge it?
Yeah, and I think what the Court of Appeals is kind of doing two different things here. First, it's looking to the statutory requirement of 15A-924 that says an indictment has to contain a plain and concise factual statement asserting facts supporting every element. And basically looking at this indictment, it says, look, it followed the language of the statute. We don't find that the defendant cited any case that requires any additional allegations in a stalking indictment to kind of fill out that theory. So on the one level, this is just not facially defective. But then further, it's citing Singleton for the proposition that even had the defendant identified some, what it says, non-jurisdictional defect, the burden is on the defendant to show prejudice. He hasn't shown that he didn't have adequate notice here. He hasn't shown that his defense was in any way impaired by the allegations or the failure to include additional allegations in this indictment. So the Court of Appeals just rejected this challenge, saying, look, if the defendant wanted additional detail, he could file a bill of particulars. This defendant apparently failed to do that.
Yeah, that seemed to be the big takeaway for me, right, is when they're saying motion to dismiss, as the prosecutor, I'm coming back saying, you filed the wrong motion, right? It's not a motion to dismiss. If you think you need more, you should have served me with a bill of particulars. And then if the judge agrees, I'll tell you more. That would be your remedy, not to just throw it out.
Right. Yeah. And then with regard to that second issue, As I said a moment ago, the pattern instruction for assault with a firearm on a law enforcement officer identifies the elements, and it has to do with the language of that pattern instruction. The first element identified in the pattern instruction is that the defendant assaulted the victim by intentionally, and here there's that parenthetical, without justification or excuse. The defendant here was arguing that that parenthetical phrase, without justification or excuse, should have been included in the pattern instruction. The defendant argued the trial court should have included the parenthetical because he presented an affirmative defense of automatism, basically that he might have drawn the gun on the officer without knowingly doing that. Defendant agreed, however, the Court of Appeals pointed out, the defendant agreed during the charge conference that he was not raising any affirmative defense. Moreover, the Court of Appeals said, the defendant's argument that he could have been asleep and reacted involuntarily is not supported by the evidence. The deputy's testimony, the Court of Appeals said, does not constitute conflicting evidence regarding the defendant's state of consciousness. So the Court of Appeals concluded that defendant's requested instruction was not supported by the evidence, and the trial court therefore did not err by failing to include that parenthetical phrase without justification or excuse. The interesting issue here for me is that typically when you get a footnote in the pattern instruction like that, the pattern instruction itself will cite controlling authority, kind of a reference for the trial court or an interested party to go back and see how that pattern instruction is supported by law. Because we know from prior cases that we've discussed here, even compliance with pattern instruction doesn't ensure the trial court against error, and departure from the pattern instruction is not necessarily erroneous. The curious thing is that the pattern instruction here, it's pattern instruction criminal 208.95, it does have this footnote. The parenthetical phrase should only be used when there's some evidence of justification or excuse, such as self-defense, but no authority is cited for that. And the Court of Appeals didn't really cite any law for that proposition either, just said, look, this pattern instruction applies only by its terms when there's some evidence of justification or excuse. There is actually an older North Carolina Court of Appeals case from 1988 called State v. Hall that held that in the absence of evidence of self-defense, it was not error for the trial court to omit that parenthetical phrase without justification or excuse. So there is sort of a legal basis for this holding. It just is a case that's not cited in the Court of Appeals opinion.
So Joe, bottom line, I mean, is it an element that I have to prove as the state that you acted without justification or excuse? Or is that like an exception to the elements?
Yeah, that's a good question. If you look in the crimes book, that's the Elements of North Carolina Crimes published by the School of Government, it does not identify this without justification or excuse language as an element of the offense.
Okay.
So I think for purposes of the case law and the statute, it's treated as an exception, a factor upon which the defendant would have to present evidence if he wants an additional instruction on that factor, right? And when there is no evidence of self-defense or a justification potential excuse for this behavior, the defendant is not entitled to that additional part of the pattern instruction and without justification or excuse. There was also in this case a little bit of a disconnect between the argument that the defendant was making and the language of the instruction that he was requesting, because defendant's argument basically was not that there was justification or excuse, but that his conduct was not intentional, right? That it wasn't knowing and intentional because he might have been asleep or acting under this defense of automatism. The instruction did actually include the word intentionally. So to the extent the defendant was making an argument that the jury had to find that this was intentional conduct, that factor at any rate was included in the instruction.
Right. So he's still got a way to try to challenge an element of the offense even
right.
without that instruction.
Yeah. The intentionality is something that certainly the state does have to prove. But whether the conduct has to be without justification or excuse, that's not something that arises unless the defendant kind of puts that at issue in the case.
Got it.
Well, that's all for today. In this episode, we discussed State v. White, finding no error in the denial of the defendant's motion to suppress when the police checkpoint complied with statutory and constitutional requirements. State v. Leggett, concluding that videos of the defendant sexually assaulting his unconscious wife were sufficiently authenticated by distinctive characteristics. And State v. Phillips, rejecting the defendant's argument that his stalking indictment was defective and that the trial court erred in its instructions on assault with a firearm on a law enforcement officer. Turning States is a collaboration between the University of North Carolina School of Government and the North Carolina Conference of District Attorneys. We're coming to you from the recording studio at the School of Government in Chapel Hill. Special thanks to our producer, Paul Bonner, and to Gustav Holtz for our music. If you liked what you heard today, if you have questions, comments, concerns, if there's an issue you'd like for us to cover in a later episode, please contact us. My name is Joseph Hyde, and I can be reached at jhyde@sog.unc.edu.
And I'm Jonathan Holbrook. I can be reached at jonathan.p.holbrook@nccourts.org.
Thank you, John. That would be the showing for the state.
Sounds good, Joe. Thanks. Hope it helps.